Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Fridays, we bring you our media roundtable. But today's roundtable is going to be a bit different. Rather than a panel of reporters, we're going to spend the full hour talking to one journalist, Sandy Tolan. And rather than the events of this week, we're going to use as our jumping-off point his remarkable new book, Children of the Stone, which tells the story of Ramzi Aroubidouane, who grew up in a refugee camp in the West Bank and became a symbol of Palestinian resistance at age 8 when a photo of him throwing a stone at Israeli soldiers in the First Intifada was published in newspapers around the world. Ramzi went on to follow a very unusual path for a kid from his circumstances, that of a concert violist who trained at a conservatory in France and then returned to the occupied territories to bring music into the lives of a generation of Palestinian children. In telling Ramzi's story, Sandy Tolan also tells the story of Israeli occupation and Palestinian resistance over the past 30 years, the bankrupt peace process, and the increasing difficulties for anyone who hopes to build understanding between Palestinians and Israelis. Sandy Tolan has produced dozens of radio documentaries for Public Radio International and NPR, and has written for more than 40 magazines and newspapers. And in addition to Children of the Stone, he's also the author of Me and Hank and the Lemon Tree. He's currently associate professor at the Annenberg School of Journalism at USC, and he joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us, Sandy, and for your book.
Thank you so much, Matt, for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you here. We always start our Friday program by asking our guests to talk about some valuable journalism that they have seen recently, whether it's a reporter, an editor, a news outlet that they want to give kudos to and credit to. So, Sandy Tolan, I wanted to start by hearing about a piece of journalism that you've seen recently that impressed you, you want to let folks know about.
Well, I thought the story, there have been a lot of pieces, obviously, that have come out in the last 24 hour about the horrible tragedy in Charleston, which some people are refusing to call a terrorist act. I thought, among the many things, I could flag a couple of pieces in the New York Times today. I thought, when there's a story like this, reporters have to get on the ground quickly and get access to people who can give some insight into what happened and who this person, who is the Dylan Roof, who is the suspect in this case, is. I thought the Times had two interesting pieces today, the New York Times. One was looking at who this guy was, and by being able to get access to a couple of childhood friends and neighbors, they got a sense not only that he was a white supremacist, which, predictably outlets like Fox News were saying he was being attacked. The church was attacked because it was a Christian church, not because it was a black church. This was completely debunked in the Times piece this morning, and not only by the Times, but by others as well. But I single out this piece because I thought they really did get to a sense of who this guy was, and that he was clearly a white supremacist, both on his Facebook page and through some of the interviews that they did with Dylan Roof's childhood friends and neighbors as well. I thought they really gave some provided some revelations into his character. And along with that, there was a piece, from my perspective, it could have been a little stronger, but just raising the question of why this is not called terrorism. When we see a Muslim American or other Muslims, attack an anti-Muhammad rally, they're called terrorists. But when a white man goes into a church and murders 9 people in cold blood, he's called mentally deranged. I think the Times piece at least raised the question as a sidebar as to whether or not this is an actual double standard, which I believe it is.
So as someone, obviously you've reported in parts of the world where the term terrorism is thrown around a lot, and where that question of when that word is invoked is really, really important. How, as a journalist, would you define it? Or how do you know it when you see it?
It really depends on one's perspective. I mean, I'm not the first person or probably even the 1,000th person to say one man's terrorists or one person's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter. Terrorism is a very political term. There are people who call suicide bombers in in Palestine, in Gaza or the West Bank, terrorists and others who call freedom fighters. There are people who say that Israel is defending itself, and others who in attacking Gaza say, for example, last summer, and others who say this is state terrorism. For me, the best thing to do is describe the action rather than put labels on it, because labels immediately put people into their camps. They drive people into their camps. What I prefer to do is describe exactly what it is that's happening. And it's not that I've never used that particular label, but I think one does so advisedly because what's most important is to actually say what's going on, what's happening.
So, Sandy Tolan, we will put links to those stories from the New York Times about the murders in Charleston yesterday on our website, yourcallradio.org, so listeners can check them out. I also want to invite listeners, if you have seen reporting this week about any story that really impressed you or that you want to draw attention to, you feel free to get in touch with us at our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Sandy, I've gotten to, over the last couple of days, read this new book of yours, Children of the Stone, which it's the story of one person. It is the story of Ramzi Abu-Ridwan and his life up to now. He's still very much alive. But it's also a really broad story about Palestinians and their life under occupation and, you know, the daily humiliations and frustrations, but also just the historic challenges that they've faced. But let's start with Ramzi. How did you first meet him, and what were your first impressions of him?
Well, I met him shortly after I began seeing these posters all around Ramallah in 1998. I was doing research for The Lemon Tree, which was my last book, and before that it was a radio documentary that aired on Fresh Air. And I was doing research for that book, and it was around the time of what Israelis call the War of Independence and Palestinians call the Nakba, or the catastrophe of 1948, during the first Arab-Israeli war. And I was looking to do a story that would be about both narratives. But during that time, as I was doing my research and trying to find such a story, I saw this poster of Ramzi. One was on this poster were two pictures. One was the picture you described of him throwing a stone at age 8 from the Al Amri refugee camp, which is right near Ramallah. And next to it was a photo of the same guy, Ramzi, but 10 years later in 1997, just a few months before I had arrived, was this poster of a young man playing the viola. And it was the same guy, and I managed to find him in Al Amri refugee camp. And we sat with him, and I took the time to do numerous interviews and did a piece for NPR that aired on Weekend Edition in 98. But during that time, he told me that he was looking... his dream was to go study the viola and get really good at it and come back. He had hoped to land a scholarship in France, come back, and then open up music schools for the children of Palestine. He had just been to a music camp in New Hampshire and was sort of thrilled with the idea of doing something like that for his own people. But he was a kid from a refugee camp who was raised by his impoverished grandparents. His grandfather was a street sweeper for the city of Albire near Ramallah, and Ramzi, starting at age 5, was his apprentice. And so here was his background, but sure enough, he did land this scholarship in France, and he ended up living there for 7 years. I kept up with him for a couple of years, then lost track, as sadly we journalists often lose track of the people that made a difference in our lives and who we got to know really well. And I always remembered Ramzi, of course, but I wasn't up on what he was doing. And by chance, by circumstance, I was in Ramallah with a couple of former Berkeley students of mine, one of whom is Ben Hubbard, who did fine work from Gaza for the New York Times last year. And I walk into Ramallah. I was on assignment for something completely different, and I hear my name being called across the restaurant, and I look over there, and there's Ramzi. And at first I didn't recognize him because he'd grown a beard, and then he points to himself, it's Ramzi. And we greet, and in the middle of the restaurant, he comes and joins us at the table. And I said, Ramzi, what are you doing? Why? I thought you were still in France. He said, no, I'm opening up music schools for the children of Palestine, which was exactly what he had told me as an 18-year-old with no resources except his own mind, his own energy, his own charisma, which obviously are substantial resources, but no financial resources at the time. And he had actually done it. And so I spent, unbeknownst to me at the time, I had no idea I would spend the next 5 years documenting not only his life, but the drama of opening a music school and then music camps and summer camps and Baroque festivals and other summer music festivals under occupation in the occupied West Bank. And then he opened some in the refugee camps in Lebanon. And it's really kind of an amazing story. And it's also a story about resilience, determination, never giving up on your dream, and what it's like for kids to try to learn music under a military occupation that's nearly half a century old.
And you know, his story, obviously, by necessity, it weaves in and out of the history of that occupation and how it's changed and, you know, the role, in greater or less, that Israel, and particularly the Israeli military, played in the life of Palestinians in the occupied territories. But take us back to, I mean, when you saw him when he's 18, he just had this experience of going to this music camp in New Hampshire, that's right? But, I mean, that's made possible by a certain historical circumstance, right? Following the Oslo Agreement, there's a period where people thought, here's this opportunity for, you know, maybe we're actually moving towards a two-state solution in concrete ways for the first time. And, you know, talk about that moment and what the possibility that was there for him and what it seemed like for Palestinians at that moment.
Yeah, that's a really important historical context for us to set. I mean, the Oslo Accords were signed, as people may remember, on the White House lawn in September of 1993 when Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands under the gaze of Bill Clinton, President Clinton. And for many people then, there was a real hope. Not for everyone. There were people who said, you know, the Palestinians need a right of return. You know, people on the Israeli side they'll never be peace. And we don't trust Yasser Arafat. There was some skepticism, but there was a lot of faith that this was actually going to lead to two sovereign states side by side in peace. There were already indications a couple of years later that maybe this wasn't so much the way it seems, because Israel was already starting to build these so-called apartheid roads, or these segregated roads on the West Bank to facilitate the travel of settlers. But at the same time, many people felt like this was a chance. I mean, there were Palestinians who were putting flowers in the gun barrels of Israeli soldiers as they departed. But they only departed from really part of the West Bank. And really from the main cities. So they retained at the time 72% and still today have 60% of the West Bank under full Israeli military control. Nevertheless, this was seen by many Palestinians, probably most in the West Bank and Gaza at the time, as the first step toward genuine sovereignty. I mean, throngs of people, thousands and tens of thousands, met Yasser Arafat's helicopter in Ramallah in 96, and he was yelling, you know, we're going to have Jerusalem, this is going to be the capital of our state, and people cheering. And so Ramzi fit into this, you know, unbeknownst to him in a way. I mean, he became a symbol of this. He became a symbol of many people's hopes. And when he went to New Hampshire, and later around the same time, actually a little bit earlier, but the American consulate arranged for American musicians to present at the Palestine National Conservatory of Music, where Ramzi was beginning to study. It was this ferment of hope that it would lead to something. And, you know, we can talk later on about how those hopes have been dashed. But absolutely, at the time, Ramzi was part of what many people put their hopes into, like, as if to say, you know, this is the beginning of a sovereign Palestine, and these are the cultural institutions that we're going to build to have an independent state. obviously didn't turn out that way.
Sandy Tolan is author of the new book, Children of the Stone. He's a veteran radio and print journalist who's covered the Middle East for a couple of decades. And his new book, Children of the Stone, tells a story of Ramzi Abu-Ridwan and puts it in the broader context of the Palestinian struggle for liberation and Israeli occupation. And I invite you listeners to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you want to talk to Sandy Tolan about the story that he tells in this book, about the broader context it's part of, or also just about the challenges of reporting on Israel and Palestine. I mean, this is certainly in the American media about as, you know, this is as third rail as it gets in terms of covering these issues. What questions do you have? And are there recent developments in the area that you'd like to talk about with Sandy Tolan? The number to call, 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Sandy, so when Ramzi, you know, he makes this decision to, he had this longstanding dream. Obviously, you met him when he was still 18 about doing this, making these schools possible. And I guess that part of what I wanted to get at, and I really got it from your book, was how important support from beyond, you know, since, you know, the occupied territories, and particularly as someone, wasn't particularly a person of means, you know, the support from kind of outside forces and the way that Oslo changed people's, in the international community's, expectations of what might be possible and how the role that they might play.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been institutional support, you know, even well beyond the time that Oslo's star faded, which was, I would say, you know, quite a while ago. But certainly at the beginning, this ferment, this hope that Oslo represented, helped Ramzi in the sense that, you know, there was a French conservatory that was looking to somehow become involved, and two of the people, including a viola teacher and the director of the conservatory in Angers in Loire Valley of France, came, and they met Ramzi and later offered him a scholarship. So it was part of that, you know, that whole process that people were participating in. But I think a lot of it was much less sort of institutional and less, in any case, linked to the Oslo era. I mean, certainly you could say that some of it was in the early years, including Ramzi's trip to New Hampshire to study and play this triumphant Mozart piano quartet in G minor, which is the subject of one of my chapters early on. But I think more, it became much more informal and more personal in a sense. People were drawn to Ramzi as a charismatic leader and as a kind of Pied Piper. He studied in France and got to be close with a lot of French musicians, most of whom, almost all of whom, had never been to Palestine, never been to the West Bank or Gaza or Israel for that matter. And who, you know, when Ramzi started experimenting with his idea, he put this together by bringing a group of French musicians to travel all across the occupied West Bank and into Gaza. This is starting in 2003, 2004, 2005. Much of this during a very heated period of the more violent Second Intifada. And here are these French musicians who are playing like troubadours, like as if they were in Paris or something. And they're in the middle of the West Bank, and Ramzi's leading them around. And a couple of them had already been there, but most had not. But it was this sort of sense of the enterprise, Ramzi's dream. He would go on these concerts. He formed his own band. In fact, that band is coming to Washington and New York, and I'm going to join them in a kind of a literary a musical tour on July 7th and 8th and other dates coming up here soon. But in the beginning of this band, he would go and say, you know, if you have any instruments to donate, he would tell the audience, don't let them sit in the attic or down in your basement gathering desk. You know, donate them to our new music school that we're dreaming of and we're putting together. And by this way, hundreds of instruments came. People would, pilgrims, Christian pilgrims, would bring them to Jerusalem, flying through Tel Aviv Airport, and then bringing them up to Ramallah. And you saw people inspired by Ramsey's story. There was one guy named Peter Sulski. He is a violist. He was with the London Symphony Orchestra, an American violist. And he met Ramsey and was so inspired by him that, you know, because he wanted to do something more with his life and give something more, give something back, he quit the LSO and now is one of the top consultants to Ramsey and is comes every year for the summer camp. And, you know, there was a woman named Julia Katarina who ended up leaving her post or her budding opera career in the UK to become the vocals teacher at Al Kamajati. None of these were institutional. And there were institutional links later, but a lot of this was personal. And when Ramsey actually started building the school, he got money from other institutions, including the Swedish Development Agency and Palestinian small by global standards Palestinian foundations. And so it was really sort of a mix of personal, of institutional, not related to Oslo, and then also some in the early days Oslo itself that helped launch Ramsey on his way and resulted in the music school that was opened in 2005.
Sandy, you're talking about those personal connections. There's a parallel story that you tell within this book, and that is that the personal connection between Israeli pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim and Edward Said, the, you know, acclaimed Palestinian intellectual, and the work that they did together then ultimately, after Said's passing, intersected with Ramsey's story.
Right. It was a really kind of a chance encounter between Barenboim and Said in, I believe, 1995 at the check-in desk at the Hyde Park Hotel in London. As Edward's, Said's widow, Miriam, tells me, as Daniel Barenboim also told me. And Edward coincidentally had tickets to a performance by Daniel in London the next night, or that evening, actually, and they met each other, sort of recognized each other, and Daniel said, "Well, I've just read your book, Culture and Imperialism." Edward was a very respected professor of comparative literature at Columbia, but also a lightning rod, very revered among Palestinian and pro-Palestinian circles, and very controversial among much of the pro-Israeli community for his staunch defense of the rights of Palestinian people. But Barenboim also considered himself sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, and the two of them wanted to do something that was an alternative to what Edward saw as an already failed peace process. And Daniel was probably not quite as skeptical as Edward was at the time, but together, along with Yo-Yo Ma in the first year, they put together a workshop in Weimar in Germany, and they called it the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. It was first just a workshop, and then it became an orchestra under Daniel Barenboim's baton. And it was interesting that in that first year when they were recruiting young Palestinian, the whole idea was to put Israelis and Arabs on the same stage and show that, as Daniel Barenboim likes to say, under Beethoven, everyone is equal. And at the time, it was Edward Said saw it as a kind of alternative to the peace process that he saw was heading nowhere, nowhere good anyway. And so they started sending invitations out by fax and elsewhere and other ways to young Arab and Israeli musicians across the region.
Sandy?
Ramsey got one
Sandy,
in France.
Sandy, I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah, but we've got to go to a break in just a moment,
okay,
and I want to make sure we get the rest of that story and also hear how Ramsey ended up being part of the Divan Orchestra and decided to leave it, I think is a very telling story. You are listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. I'll be right back.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We podcast our program. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows. And telling you what's coming up next on Monday, we're going to have a conversation about gentrification with journalist and filmmaker D.W. Gibson. He's written a new book called The Edge Becomes the Center, An Oral History of Gentrification in the 21st Century. He talks to a whole range of people in New York City about what gentrification looks like in their lives. We'll want to hear what it looks like in yours here in Northern California. That's coming up on Monday. Today, we are having a special media roundtable where we're talking with Sandy Tolan, veteran journalist who's come out with a new book called Children of the Stone. And Sandy, when we just last left things, we were talking about this orchestra that Edward Said, Daniel Barenboim, and Yo-Yo Ma put together and how there were invitations to, obviously, to Arab and Israeli musicians, both, you know, in the occupied territories in Israel as well as the diaspora. I know that Ramzi got one of those invitations and actually was discouraged by one of his teachers from actually taking it first time around, but later tried to, you know, meet Daniel Barenboim a couple of different times, and then ultimately they did connect, and he became part of the Divan Orchestra. And you tell some, it's just fascinating stories in the book about Barenboim's attempt. On one hand, you know, he's someone who spoke out against the occupation, probably one of the foremost Israeli voices criticizing Israeli government policy. But at the same time, the tensions of trying to hold together that orchestra and why Ramzi ultimately decided he needed to leave and separate from it.
Yeah, you know, Ramzi was, you know, as our many Palestinians have been over the years, you know, impressed with Barenboim's personal stance. I mean, he once accepted one of the top prizes for artists in Israel, called the Wolf Prize, given by members of the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and did so by, in his acceptance speech, denouncing the occupation. He's one of the few people, if not the only one, who's accepted Palestinian citizenship as an Israeli. So his personal stance has impressed many Palestinians. And Ramzi felt when he joined the orchestra that it would be made up of like-minded people who supported, as he puts it, my people's freedom. When he first got there, when he finally accepted Daniel Barenboim's invitation, after Daniel had accepted his invitation to have tea with his grandfather in the refugee camp where Ramzi was raised, which impressed Ramzi, he then accepted the invitation. And in that first year was 2006, when Israel had just invaded Lebanon, and there were a million people in flight, in Lebanese people. Most of the Lebanese musicians didn't make it that year, and Ramzi was shocked to find that most of the Israeli musicians that he was talking to supported the war. And so he thought, wait a minute, I thought this was and some of them were former members of the army. And so he began to think, this isn't quite the orchestra that I thought it was. So he left for a time that summer. Daniel Barenboim called him and urged him to come back. They began a dialogue. He invited Ramzi to speak out. Ramzi would speak at press conferences across Europe, telling his story and his people's story. Daniel Barenboim continued to make what, at least by comparison, are very courageous statements. But he refused and declined to invoke the entire orchestra, saying the orchestra also opposes the occupation of Palestinians by Israel. Ramzi became more and more frustrated by that, and over the years was trying to change Daniel's mind, trying to change the orchestra members, the Israeli orchestra members' mind. And then one year he met someone who was raised in a settlement, a cellist.
Israeli.
He had a big argument. An Israeli cellist who was raised in a settlement called Gilo near Jerusalem. And he then went to Daniel and said, why do you have a settler in the orchestra? And Daniel said, well, he lives in Poland now. And he said, but yeah, but he was raised there, and he hasn't renounced, you know, his settler status. And as a matter of fact, the fellow says, well, I'm from a suburb of Jerusalem, which is a huge point of contention for Palestinians and for most of the international community. So eventually Ramzi felt like, unless the orchestra is willing to make a statement denouncing the occupation, I don't believe that it is institutionally in favor of the freedom for my people, and I can no longer in good conscience stay. And it was really, it's really one of the saddest moments in the book for me, because it shows, it's in a way, it's metaphorically parallels the rise and fall of the Oslo era, of what I call an era of dialogue, which has now been replaced by a much more of an era of direct, mostly nonviolent confrontation in the boycott movement and others, the so-called BDS movement, and other sort of nonviolent ways to confront the Israeli occupation, which Ramzi and his students have also taken part in. But Ramzi felt in good conscience he couldn't stay in the orchestra. And he, you know, I just was in the West Bank a couple weeks ago, and he spoke about how much he missed Daniel. And when I spoke with Daniel a couple of years back, he basically said the same thing about Ramzi. So it's really quite a sad thing.
So Sandy, I want to bring in one of our listeners who's called into 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Dan in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hey, thanks for having me over. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I pulled over here in the Ingleside District in San Francisco, across from Ramallah Hall. Thought you might be find that interesting. Just to listen to your show, quite a coincidence. And to call in to ask, I'm learning a lot about music and the arts, and it's really wonderful. I'm also curious. I was aware there was a program that American baseball coaches were trying to go over there to Palestine, to see if they could work with some of the kids and the teens, bringing that game over there, and it got canceled. This is about maybe a decade ago.
I hadn't heard of that.
I would certainly think that baseball is not one of the top sports, but I was just curious. That was my specialty, but with soccer, that they've had some successes with having some teams, and I'm just wondering if there's any other kind of things that not only Arab and Israeli or Palestinian Israeli, but also just in general for the young people coming up, something that could give them some hope in the sports world as well.
Dan,
that's just really my question of anything you may have heard sports-wise, and not to take away from the really interesting stuff you've already mentioned here on the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay, good question. I have to say I'm not an expert on it, and I think that it could be quite a challenge for baseball to make inroads in the Gaza and the West Bank, because soccer, or as most of the world knows it, as football, not American football, but football, what we call soccer, is just, the champ. And there are some children's games, and people play volleyball and occasionally basketball. But also, especially in the refugee camps, there's not enough space, frankly. Baseball requires, if not green, at least, available space, which generally speaking, in the villages and particularly in the refugee camps, which are, by and large, very grim places that are very densely packed, it's enough to just get a very small clearing of abandoned land, or maybe even someone's home that's been destroyed by Israeli bulldozers. They'll move the rocks, and they'll create a soccer field. And it's really not a field so much as a vacant lot. So for that reason, alone, especially, and in addition to the sort of cultural reasons, I think it would probably be a long time before baseball, as much as I love it personally and wrote a book about it, will make any inroads in the Arab world that I'm aware of. But it is interesting that classical music as well as Arabic music is not only being offered by Ramzi, but it's really a huge amount of availability across the West Bank and Gaza, as well as other forms of the arts. Theater, there's something called the Freedom Theater in Jenin, and other forms of expression are really taking hold.
Sandy, so you start this book in the introduction by saying that, you've made a decision in this book to do something that's different from most traditional reporting about mm-hmm. Palestinians and Israelis. You're not going to go back and forth between Palestinian perspectives and Israeli perspectives, something you did in your last book, The Lemon Tree, but instead to really tell a Palestinian story. you know, a little, I mean, obviously you had a great story to tell, so I understand why you would choose to tell that story. But how has that, affected the way, I know you've been both to Israel and the occupied territories recently, and, you know, and in the U.S., how has it affected, do you think, how it's been received?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the jury's still out in your last question. You know, I think basically when people hear about this issue, if it's involving Palestinians, people in the United States will expect also to have equal treatment from an Israeli perspective. And that certainly was the case with the Lemon Tree, because it was built on a story that was a story of two families. And I think generally speaking, in this country, we've been raised, Jew and Gentile alike, with some exceptions, on what I call the Leon Uris Exodus version of history, which is the story of Israeli, the heroic birth of Israel out of the Holocaust and, you know, the ashes of that tragedy. And not so much about the story of a tragedy called the Nakba, or the catastrophe from a Palestinian perspective. That's what a lot of the Lemon Tree was about, is showing that there are two sides. What engaged me first about and led me to do this book is, first of all, as you said, Matt, it's the story itself. I mean, it's, for me, I mean, I've been telling stories as a journalist and honing my skills and trying to tell better and better narrative stories, you know, for 30-some years. And it's really initially all about whether the story itself is compelling. When I first read a part of my book proposal to some friends and members of the public in Gloucester, Massachusetts, right before I had even submitted my proposal to my literary agent, I read a sample chapter. It was very rough at the time, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, well, this is a really good story of this Palestinian violist, but couldn't you also find, like, an Israeli violinist and then have the story about the two of them? And I said, no. I mean, I technically could, but the story here is about the experience, which I feel is so underrepresented in this country, partly because of what I was talking about just a moment ago. It's so the experience of Palestinians under occupation, despite the fact that, you know, forests of trees have fallen in newsprint over the years in telling the story. We know so much about the U.S.-Israeli relationship, for example, but precious little about what it's like to be a child living in an occupied land, which is so directly linked to our own policy here. Not that the U.S. policy officially favors the occupation, but our policy has actually helped facilitate that, in my opinion. And for us to not know what the human costs of that are, I think has been a shame. But I didn't want to write a polemic. I didn't want to write a policy paper. I wanted to write something that was a compelling story that would get you into the lives of these children and of Ramzi, their leader, in a sense, in the music school, and get you to care about these kids and then see what it is they're dealing with every day.
Well, you describe that everyday life quite vividly in the book. I can say, having read it, Children of the Stone.
Thank you.
Is Sandy
Thank
Tolan's you. New book. And we have a caller on the line, Jim in Oakland. Jim, welcome to your call.
Thank you. Great to get a chance to ask Sandy something. I'm a longtime member of Jewish Voice for Peace. And what you're talking about touches on this issue that's come up a lot, I think, from some Palestinian activists now, is this issue with normalization, and working together isn't necessarily a problem, but depends on, you know, what the politics of the Israelis or the more Zionist partner is. And then also, I'm wondering if you would, and what you were just saying about the violins and the request for balance, and, well, what about showing something positive about Israelis or even about Jews, conflating the two? And it comes up with this movie called All Helm, about Martin Luther King, about some gospel singers that went to the Freedom Theater, which you just mentioned, in Jenin, right before Giuliano Merakamis was assassinated, doing a play with the Palestinian National Theater about the life of Martin Luther King, and the documentary by Connie Field, award-winning documentarian from Berkeley, who did Have You Heard from Johannesburg and Rosie the River. Amazing movie. And the critique is, well, what about telling stories about Jewish, you know, civil rights struggle? Because this shows apolitical African-American gospel singers, a group of six or seven, going to the West Bank, not knowing what they're getting into, and then having their eyes somewhat opened, if not quite politicized. So that was an amazing story, and you mentioned the Freedom Theater. So this question about normalization, and then finally I'll shut up and let you answer. There is an issue coming up now around the State Department definition of anti-Semitism, which includes
Jewish Voice for Peace has gotten very much involved.
They're trying to get the California state to accept it and the UC system. And so this is a big issue. So comments on any of that, normalization, and the Sulha Peace Project were just here too. So thank you very much. Didn't mean to ramble.
Thanks, Jim.
No, that's okay. Thanks for your call. There's a lot there. I would have to say on your last point, I think the definition of anti-Semitism and the State Department definition is actually quite important, because one thing that has been coming out both from Prime Minister Netanyahu and members of what was going to be a secret meeting and turned out to be not so secret in Las Vegas was Sheldon Adelson and other backers of Republican presidential candidates. There is a sense that criticizing Israel is equated with anti-Semitism. To me, and Jewish Voice for Peace has raised its voice in a very strong way, which I think is very important, that's absolutely not the case. And the people who are the members of the or supporters, at least of some aspects or all aspects of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, have also made it clear that it's not... The point is not to criticize Judaism or Jews, but the policies of Israel. And to me, to not be able to look at the impact of the occupation on ordinary lives and describe it as it is, when you have, you know, more than 500 checkpoints or other kinds of barriers in a land the size of the American state of Delaware, when you have... night raids and other arrests that have resulted in 40% of the adult male population of Palestinians in the occupied territories spending time in prison. When you have, an incident back in April documented by an Israeli human rights organization of Palestinians bathing in a swimming pool in what is supposed to be sovereign Palestinian territory, being expelled by soldiers so that settlers can bathe. Pointing these things out is not anti-Semitic. On the contrary, as Jewish Voice for Peace leaders would say, it's quite the opposite. I mean, it's in any case, it's not anti-Semitic. So I think that's important. In terms of normalization, I mean, I think I'm not a spokesperson for this movement, but I would say, from what I understand of it, the question of joining hands together to create what, in going back to Rumsey's experience with the Divan Orchestra, he felt that it was creating a false impression of harmony, and not by not pointing out what the reality is on the ground and not denouncing it. So that is one example of what people who are in the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement and other critics of Israeli policies would call normalization, is when we create a false impression of harmony. And I think that's probably the dividing line. In terms of this, I hadn't heard of that film and that experience. It sounds wonderful, but from what I can tell of it, it doesn't sound like anyone would call that normalization.
And Sandy, you have been reporting on Palestinians and Israelis for decades. And I'd just be interested in terms of your long-term view about, particularly in the U.S. media. I mean, I think when we look at the policy, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, reading your book, you look at the U.S. government policy, it's remarkably consistent, from one administration to the next. But I'm interested in what you see as changes in the U.S. media when it comes to covering these issues, whether there's an appetite for covering these issues, and if so, how the stories, especially those real stories of people's experiences under occupation, are being covered.
Well, I think there are many, many fine exceptions, and there was some great reporting, including from people like Ben Hubbard in the New York Times out of Gaza. I also thought the New York Times did a disservice to its readers by not being much more skeptical of Israel's explanation, if you want to call it that, of exonerating itself for the death of the four boys in Gaza last summer, the Baker boys who were playing hide-and-seek on the beach. And there was a direct eyewitness account by a Guardian reporter that the New York Times, for whatever reason, chose not to interview. You know, there is, I think, a sense that, you know, the old Leon Uris narrative of which translates today, in my view, to will Israelis be secure? I think that's a legitimate question, but it has to be only one question. What about Palestinians? What about Palestinian freedom? What about their rights to travel freely, to live in their own nation that's not under a military occupation to this day? So I think that's a harder sell, to have those kinds of stories. I mean, I'm certainly being published in various places when I write op-eds or you know, story of my recent trip to Hebron, which was, you know, never fails to shock, and or driving across the West Bank and seeing, you know, raised olive groves that have been either uprooted or cut or burned by settlers. These stories do get into the press from time to time. I mean, especially not into the mainstream press as much, especially in the alternative press. But I think that they deserve equal coverage and treatment so that people really understand what's happening. And in terms of the U.S. role, I mean, it's interesting to me that as much as U.S. presidents and secretaries of state have said, essentially, please don't, or we don't approve of you expanding your settlements, it hasn't been since before the beginning of the Oslo Accords, 1992, when James Baker was Secretary of State under the first President Bush, that the U.S. has basically threatened financial repercussions if Israel does not continue building settlements. Baker said that and basically said, you know, Prime Minister Shamir has my phone number. If he decides to stop building settlements, then we will guarantee $10 billion in loan guarantees. Nothing like that has happened since, and I think that's because of the power of Israel's lobby, which, by the way, is not the Jewish lobby. It's the Israel lobby, and there are many Zionist Christians who are part of that. I think the power has grown to an extent that domestic American politicians don't want to touch that third rail, as you call it, Matt.
And so I want to just invite listeners. We've got a few more minutes here with Sandy Tolan, longtime reporter, and has a new book out called Children of the Stone. If you have questions or comments on what Sandy's been saying about coverage of Israel and Palestine, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And Sandy, you were talking a bit about your recent reporting about Hebron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Give us a little taste of what you saw.
You know, it's I wrote a piece for Truthdig and Mondo Weiss this week. People could look them up, but I have to say it's one of the most surreal places on earth that I've ever been, and I've been, you know, reporting in 35 countries or so. You know, first of all, we drove through the West Bank, and you could see every time I go there, it's kind of a shock to see the expansion of the settlements. A little settlement of Ephrat is now, you know, well over 10,000 people. It stretches for almost 2 miles. You can't really travel through the West Bank anymore without seeing strong evidence of the occupation, both in terms of the settlements themselves, the military towers, the military surveillance, the segregated roads, the wall, the barriers. But Hebron itself is such a frightening and almost despairing place. There are 120 checkpoints within Hebron. It's most of the people, the Jewish settlers are 400 to 600, being protected by at least 1,500 soldiers in a city of Palestinians that's 170,000. The area known as H2 is this designation under the Oslo process that was signed by the Palestinian Authority as well as others, that basically sanctions this, allows this to happen. It was supposed to be temporary, but since the attack by Baruch Goldstein, a settler from Brooklyn that murdered 29 people praying in the Ibrahimi Mosque. The Israeli government has and military have chosen to punish Palestinians by closing something called Shuhada Street, which was one of the bustling main streets. They welded the doors to the shops, many of the shops shut. Some of the residents nearby have to climb ladders to get home. And above the Arab market, because the settlers and the Palestinians are sort of cheek to jowl in some of the same or adjacent buildings, the settlers hurl chairs and bottles and bags of feces to try to disrupt the Palestinian market. So they've erected steel screens. We saw a parking lot that was a parking lot for buses from the settlements that had been a Palestinian play area where they used to play soccer and volleyball. Now it's off limits so that the settler buses can park there. It's really quite shocking, and it's among the worst. And to say nothing of Gaza and excepting Gaza, it's one of the worst landscapes in all of Palestine. And it's been perpetuated now for some 20 years. But I feel that it can't stand. This whole structure really ultimately can't stand because it's not it's not only on moral grounds or even economic grounds, but just a system like this cannot exist forever.
Well, Sandy Tolan, thank you so much for being with us this hour. We will link to your reporting on Hebron, as well as have information about your new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, at our website, yourcallradio.org. It's been great to talk with you today.
Terrific talking to you, Matt. Thanks for all your good questions.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to our weekly media roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. What does gentrification mean to you? On the next Your Call, we'll talk to D.W. Gibson, journalist and author of The Edge Becomes the Center, an oral history of gentrification in the 21st century. By interviewing a wide cross-section of New Yorkers, from a drug dealer to a bank executive, Gibson gets inside the varied ways people experience and perceive the transformation of neighborhoods by the influx of new wealth and new residents. What does gentrification look like where you live? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Owen Bennett-Jones, host of BBC NewsHour, and on today's programme, the British Prime Minister asks Muslim families in the UK to stop blaming the government for the radicalisation of their children. We'll be discussing that on NewsHour.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, feminist, Chicana, legend. Well, that would be Sheree Moraga.
The relationship between men and women and the freedom that men had was so distinct from my own life experience. I wanted to be my brother because he was free.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Latina USA at 1 o'clock today, followed by the BBC News Hour at 2, right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Find us online at kalw.org. Up next at 11 o'clock, it's a special from Reveal with your host, Al Letson. Stay tuned.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
Our country is facing serious energy problems.
In the 70s, the energy crisis brought America to its knees. We had to come up with a solution. So visionaries in the oil industry drove their teams hard.
He says, if you team, don't think you're up to this challenge, let me know. I'll find people who are. I had a wife and four kids. I said, we could do it, boss.
And it worked. America is now in the midst of an energy boom. But at what cost?
Oklahoma City 911, what's your emergency?
I thought it felt an earthquake.
Yes, sir, we had one.
Did we have an earthquake?
Yes, we did, sir.
Yes, ma'am, we had an earthquake. Are you okay?
Oklahoma now has more seismic activity than California, in part because of oil drilling.
Is there going to be more?
We have no idea.
The true cost of the power